Good morning. It's me. Can you hear me?
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more,
Howdy, y'all. I'm going to try to do this in one shot. This is going to be a bunch of readings from the Cenacle of the summer 2020. Cenacle, okay. I'm getting a message from Facebook here. Okay, it's fine. Yes, I can't tag people. So I want to start with a quotation from John Berryman from the New Yorker, which is the following: writers should be heard and not seen. So that grumpy old guy had us nailed here. And a poem by Louise Gluck, who recently won some prize or other. This is called Song by Louise Gluck, and then I'll read from the Cenacle. Leo Cruz makes the most beautiful white bowls. I think I must get some to you, but how is the question in these times? He is teaching me the names of desert grasses. I have a book, since to see the grasses is impossible. Leo thinks the things man makes are more beautiful than what exists in nature. And I say no. And Leo says, wait and see. We make plans to walk the trails together. When, I ask him, when? Never again. That is what we do not say. He is teaching me to live in imagination. A cold wind blows as I cross the desert. I can see his house in the distance. Smoke is coming from the chimney. That is the kiln, I think. Only Leo makes porcelain in the desert. Ah, he says, you were dreaming again. And I say, then I'm glad I dream. The fire is still alive. So that was Louise Gluck. But the fire is still alive. And now turning to The Cenacle, published by Raymond Sollard and available online. Get it everywhere. Fine literature is downloaded for free off the internet. First pieces are some protest poems by Timothy Vilgiati, who I believe is in Colorado. This one is called Wholesome Strangers. So Timothy Vilgiati first, then Raymond Sollard Jr. With What Is Bag's End, which is a discussion of how his fictional world is permutated, how he created it and what's in it. Sam Knott with A Kind of Butterfly Song, this is my favorite Sam Knott poem ever so far, and I want all of his other poems to be like this or variations on it. That will make sense when I read the poem. Tamara Miles, Church in the Greenhouse. So she has invited us to be part of her greenhouse church down there in South Carolina. Happy to be a parishioner there. John Etchem joining Cenacle for the second or third time now with Life as a Forest, he would say. John being the first of two Cenacle participants from distant, remote, exciting Nigeria. Jimmy Heffernan is going to come in with a short note on UFOs in essay form. Another poem, Tom Sheen, called Coupled. Then Martina Newberry, it's all poems from here on in. Martina Newberry, Clouds Like Boxcars. Ace Bogus with Another Earth-like Planet. And rounding out the pack, Colin James. If I'm still sitting in a vertical position here at the end, Colin James with Caligula in Texarkana. So jumping now with both feet into Timothy Vilgiati's poem, Wholesome Strangers. Well that you are, be ye well what you are, wholesome strangers, pleasant folk who rattle on by. My stars, all my stars, orbits, systems, inhibitions. Wholesome strangers who watch me wondering if I'm a cop, or an anti-fascist from out of town here to cause trouble, or another white kid here to party, to smoke weed on the median in front of City Hall, wearing a wire, over-invested, falsely invested, under-invested. But I admire them, the strangers. I find their presence wholesome. The six-year-olds playing on the statue, the widows, the hopeful young eyes drinking in their first protest, the eyes of elders, shimmering flames, righteous anger, blood-soaked pain. I see a city that desperately shouts, "I've got your back!" and wants to mean it. I see a community built on love between strangers, in the shadow of the city's generously licked boot, soaked in the saliva of even the liberal dudes on city council, which looms over our heads, covered in flailing tongues, a buzzing drone, a militia on the rooftop, videos on Facebook, Antifa in Colorado Springs. We know all too well we are being watched, and yet we simmer in rebellion, laughing, hugging in spite of the pandemic. It feels like we're exiting a dream and re-entering ever slower into waking life, or is it another dream? Leaving our beds, eating breakfast, making signs and heading to the protest, staying out till 10:30. All this after 2 months in isolation, we wake up in a revolution called rioters while being slammed into the pavement, pepper sprayed, tear gassed, false flagged, infiltrated. For God knows how long I had sat on my couch doing my duty, staying in, seeing all of my friends and coworkers only through webcam. How strange it was to see them in person. Stranger. Wholesome. Next poem is called An Hour After Standing Before the Courthouse. We marched down Bijou, and I thought we might even make it to the interstate and block it off. And so, mindful of the danger, I texted my wife, "We are blocking traffic. I don't know when I'll be home." But before we got to the interstate, we turned left and circled around, drawing a wider circle than before when we'd gone to the courthouse. Bystanders cheered, stopping at green lights in their cars. I took their patience of the bystanders for granted. 30 minutes later, someone was hit. A white Jeep ran over them on purpose. We called for the police, who reluctantly arrested the driver and threw a flashbang into the restless crowd. The nightly news said the protesters attacked a car, jumped on the hood. Before it happened, I drove home, since my wife was afraid. She didn't want me to stay out all night and get tear gassed again, since she wouldn't sleep, and would drive out downtown to look for me and see if I got arrested or shot. So if you're just joining me now, this is once again readings from The Cenacle, summer 2020, and this current writer is Timmy Vilgiati. Last piece by him, "Mysterious ruins found off the Pikes Peak Greenway. There's a temple underneath this interstate highway system, the ruins of a long-dead society of skaterpunks, who modified the surface of the ground with cement, river rock, rusted metal, and curved wood to create a skate park." Actually, an illustration of this here. The temple of skaterpunks. The lost temple of skaterpunks. "Wandering inside, a stranger to the temple, I find it empty, and I'm unsure if the paint covering up the old graffiti is decades old, or if the city came by just yesterday, or how recently the newer-looking paint of the letters spray-painted over the city's hasty monochrome power play arrived on the walls. Surely there are layers of history if only one could peel them back and see them. I want to occupy the ruins with my anarchist friends and have a river party, string blankets from the concrete pillars, and let music blare as people soar by on their skateboards and scooters and rollerblades. I want to reclaim the temple for the people, to revive the decadent fearlessnesses of the rebellion, to drink flour with butane flames passing over hot glass. I want the people to shout and the space to echo back our voices. I want it to become an island in the city outside of the cameras and the tracking and the racial profiling, to no longer glance suspiciously over my shoulder to see if I'm being followed or watched. I'm held back by a subtle terror, images of the violence of the prisons, the inevitable swiftness and the firmness of the law, distant as I feel from it. Would they let us merely be free to claim this space, to cover the walls in paint and use it as a safe harbor? The fear is a new feeling for me, though not for others. I grew up believing that the police would never bother people who behaved respectfully, blissfully unaware of the reality faced by people who look different from me, who have darker skin, or different accents, or simply different ways of being. I grew up taking for granted that I had the protection of a whispering army, that the cameras on the walls were there to keep us safe, that the presence of armed men on the street corners lurking behind tinted windows was the lone barrier between order and chaos. I came to learn that this was comforting mythology, nothing more. I saw the videos. I saw the burning precinct in Minneapolis. I saw the wordless stares of children in the elementary schools who had nightmares about the police. I saw the city mourn. Devon Bailey killed by police while running away. Breonna Taylor killed by police while sleeping. George Floyd choked to death by police on the street. And I saw as well the allegiances of old family friends and former classmates become clear. Saw the true face of my fellow people when faced with injustice and the opportunity for change. If invited, how many would come to the temple? So, Protest Poems by Timothy Vilgiati. Coming up on Raymond Solar Jr., What is Bag's End? And there's a quotation from an earlier writing on the same topic by him. I can't explain Bag's End in a linear way. Can't even do it fully and finally in a non-linear way, but I can start somewhere and branch out this way, that way, till a tree is outlined, then a few, a woods, a gate, an island, or four bags, one of them red. Apartment building, kinda, looking within. So jumping in, number four. Algernon Beagle writes his beloved newspaper with his partner and adopted sister, Lori Bunny. Lori types the newspaper on an old manual write typer, which was a gift from Algernon's dear friend, Princess Krizika of Imagiana. Emandia is a faraway planet of woods and sea with six islands. It is similar in many ways to Bag End's world, which is similar in many ways to ours. These worlds, in my current speculation, braid somehow together. Its inhabitants look like frail, wispy little beings, yet they are nearly immortal. Their planet suffers a long, slow disaster that eventually wipes out most of all the life upon it. Though very different from the humans on this world, yet the Amandians too ruin theirs and react to stop this ruin far too late to avert it. Much of the story of what happens on Emandia I do not yet know. What I do know is that they manage to save a small part of their population by sending them to the stars, some by spaceship, some by the red bag through the dreaming, and some by single-occupant capsules. All of these are sent to worlds deemed similar to Emandia, with woods, seas, and islands. The world of Bag's End is one of them. These ideas are loosely based on the ancient aliens' theory of human origins, essentially that humanity either sources in the stars or has evolved in part by long-ago alien contact. I tend to think they're both part of the truth. Another of the islands is where arrived the Tangled Gate, a structure built in dreams by the architect in service of the Emandians. The Tangled Gate is a great labyrinth of immense and changing size. This island, source of most Emandians in the world, eventually shuts itself off from the world and cannot be found on any map. Only by the heroic journey of a king and his fellowship of brother knights in a time of desperate need is the nature of the island revealed, to a degree. The knight's quest is told more fully in my poetry series, Many Musics. Algernon learns of all this and becomes part of a newer quest to unite the six islands as they had long ago been, but in a new way. Everything grows closer together as these newer stories progress. At the heart of the world is a great tree, inspired somewhat by Yggdrasil, the ash tree, at the center of the cosmos in Norse mythology. The great tree in these stories, with its green and golden bells, reaches its branches up through the deeper, deeper sea to the deep, deep sea, to the heart of each of the six islands in the wide, wide sea. From each great tree branch emerges a smaller great tree on each of these islands, and from each of these lesser great trees grows up the white woods that covers most of these islands. By his many travels, Algernon Beagle learns of the White Woods and of the great tree at the heart of the world, and of lost Demandia and the stars above, and much more of his world than what he had known before. There's a hut near the roots of the great tree at the heart of the world. This hut is dark within, save for the soft glow emitting from a frozen rainbow falls that form its interior instead of walls. This hut is a live conduit to unitive time, if one knows how to travel its way. Simply looking deeply and closely into the frozen rainbow falls is not enough. What is within looks blurry and nothing more appears. However, by closing one's eyes and mmming the right mmm, then opening one's mind's eyes, one will arrive to unitive time. A short visit is advisable. The ancien woods, the all-pervading hmm, the enveloping symbiosis of the dreaming will absorb the visitor after not too long. And I have to cough my inevitable cough. Excuse me, this is a family cough. I inherited this from my father, my uncle, and my grandmother, in fact, before us. This is the Horowitz family throat clearing. The hmm is a kind of tongue, a guide, a salve, a music, many kinds of magic. It is native to all in these stories. My dear friend Jim Burke III, himself a kind of Celtic Buddhist, heathen mystical artist, would often talk of the one note or om of Indian religions, a sacred spiritual sound believed to be the source of truth and origin. The spaceships have always been overhead, and they are from Emandia, them being one of the ways Emandians come to the story's world, in addition to the red bag and capsules. This long story of Raymond's, I've often imagined it in like books like this or something. Like it should be in paperback novels, but Raymond tells me there's like 3,000 pages of it. So it sort of exists in electronic form online and in the minds and hearts of people who enter it through the literature of it. This is the Red Bag story. I could tell you that we come from the Red Bag, and it would be almost true, but not enough. You see, the Red Bag is how we got here, and through the Red Bag is where we're from. It's like through the door of the Red Bag, just on the other side is our original home. If you tried to get there the usual way, it would take you millions of miles, many centuries, and you would arrive so much later than now, but through the door of the Red Bag you would arrive now, a few steps, a few seconds. Except you wouldn't find our world. Our world is gone. It's a dead, dark place. We left unwillingly. We could hardly bring everyone or anything or everything, or a beautiful world itself. We bought a remnant, a sliver. Are we dead? No. Are we as alive as we were back in our own world? No. We compromised to keep this remnant of our existence still existing. The plan has been so much more ambitious. Plans, that is, as so many brilliant minds sacrificed their years to leaving our sad, dying world. They agreed, one and all, we waited too long. We simply ran out of all the time needed to bring all our world had. It was arrogance, fear, denial. We at first believed our plight was minor, then that help would come. Most of us surrendered to the inevitable and despaired. But enough of our most brilliant minds kept working, kept trying, trying and flailing and trying some more. The Red Bag was a compromise, but it shouldn't have been. When time was getting desperately low, our scientists, preachers, magicians, seers, poets came together at last, put away their arrogance and prejudice, worked together as one group, learned each other's languages, powers, skills, began to braid science, magic, vision, music together, grew powerful even as time grew shorter, realized what might have been. The skies got blacker and one day did not lighten again. The air became thicker, less breathable. The trees began to fall, the animals to die. We knew we couldn't build a ship that would reach anywhere habitable in time. What happened instead was that we built a portal that would take us directly to somewhere else, but it would only bear so much, and only one trip. Some of our best stayed behind, sacrificed themselves to operate the apparatus. How did we choose? Not as we wished to, not the weak and small in combination with our strongest and bravest. It didn't work that way. We chose those who together could sustain our new home, whose peculiar abilities would, in combination, succeed in establishing our new home. Even then, when the tests had been run and the individuals determined, there were hard decisions to be made. None chosen would grow old or die, and the population would never change. What we were doing, all we were doing, was preserving that remnant, saving a bit. The day came when we had to go. The world was collapsing so that even deep under the surface was no protection. We gathered with what the scientists and priests and poets and the rest had determined we both could and should bring. The instructions were simple. Close your eyes and imagine yourself on the other side of the door of the red bag. The moment came and we arrived. Here, beyond the reach of death and time, and knowing that long ago our old world perished. What nobody told us was what we would find, or that we would not be alone, or how each of us had been picked, or why. It made a kind of cruel sense. Would it have worked if we had known we were going to dreamland forever? I think those brilliant lost minds could not be sure and took no chances. They looked like the creatures from our old world we called turtles. They were the first we met. They welcomed us and were kind. We became friends. I'm writing this story because for the longest time, we were paralyzed refugees, living huddled near our few possessions from home. We seemed safe, but we were petrified. Yet, being younger than most of the rest, known to get my curious nose into trouble back home, I eventually began to inspect what we had brought. One small case, green and gold, attracted me most. I found paper, pencils, paintbrushes, musical instruments, and other things. We were supposed to remember as best we could and live on. So, Raymond Solar Jr. with stories from The Tangled Gate, The Red Bag, Bag's End. What is the red bag? Sam Knott coming to us from a farm in northern France, where he lives with his wife and horses and tons of animals, with a poem called A Kind of Butterfly Song. Sam Knott, A Kind of Butterfly Song. Everything is a kind of butterfly. Think of the butterfly fish, or books, which quite clearly open wings with asymmetric textual patternings. Tree trunks stake a claim to being butterfly torsos. Also, they can fly sideways with one wing in the earth, like night is the other wing of day. Undifferentiated chaos is not a kind of butterfly, but nor is it at all. The only stuff which is not butterfly might be moth. Caterpillar, like snake or worm, is butterfly sans wings. Cocoon, the dream of butterfly being, but a recapitulation of the egg. While inside and outside, like yolk and white, the circle's wings bespeak. Nothing is not some sort of butterfly, not brain, not mind, not space, not time, are not butterflies. Even nothing is a butterfly of kinds. Apples and oranges have differences which open like wings and sing that the only way they are the same is in being kinds of butterfly. Fruit cocoons have never tasted so good. Upon the butterfly tongue of the dirt path, the wagtail settles with butterfly smile while the hare goes by with butterfly gravity. The peacock of the heart's flutter struts in space while through time the flower opens in butterfly rotations to the pitch of a butterfly bee. And the butterflies passed unmysteriously as entire lifetimes metamorphose ceaselessly in every nectarous, effortless death drop of changingly changeless butterfly nature. Our beautiful dream of being true to our selvan cocoons never tasted so good as something else like each of us, butterfly light in love with butterfly emptiness. Tamara Miles, Church in the Greenhouse, Pandemic Journal. So this is a picture of the church in the greenhouse, real place, visitable through literature, visual art, red bags, tangled gates. Church in the greenhouse. April 24th, and in an earlier issue of the Cynical, she explained this, that this is her, well, it's a church, it's a greenhouse, it's a little, you'll see. April 24th, 2020, coiled. So this begins with a quotation from Sean O'Casey, 1934. There is a deeper life than the life we see and hear with the open ear and the open eye, and this is the life important and the life everlasting. Sean O'Casey, 1934. So Tamara Miles, Church in the Greenhouse, April 24th, 2020, coiled. My beloved partner David has been warning me about snakes in my greenhouse and out in the backyard garden beds. Wear shoes, he says, and bring out mothballs. It's timely, then, that I'm studying Kundalini Yoga today. Kundalini means coiled in Sanskrit, and the serpent snake is revered in Hindu spiritual practice. This reviled creature, St. Patrick literally or figuratively banished them from Ireland, is a subject of fascination for me. One of my favorite poems is The Snake by D.H. Lawrence, in which the speaker engages with a snake at his fountain. It's experiencing imagination and revulsion in equal parts. Part of what makes the poem delightful is Lawrence's expert use of the sound S throughout. You'll want to read the whole thing, but here is its marvelous beginning. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I, in pajamas for the heat, to drink there. In the deep, strange, scented shade of the great dark carob tree, I came down the steps with my pitcher and must wait, must stand and wait, for there he was at the trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom and trailed his yellow-brown slackness soft-bellied down over the edge of the stone trough and rested his throat upon the stone bottom, and where the water had dripped from the tap in a small clearness, he sipped with his straight mouth, softly drank through his straight gums into his slack, long body, silently. There's an intensity in the speaker's attention to the snake. Similarly, the snake shape works in Kundalini Yoga as the idea of moving upward in the chakras, giving full attention to each. A sense of warmth rises in the body as this happens successfully. Each chakra is also associated with a deity. For example, Shiva is the god of destruction and transformation. In the mythology of Shiva, we can better understand how even when something seems destroyed, rebirth will occur and we can begin again. This Shiva is not to be confused with the Jewish practice of the same name, the first 7 days of mourning for the passing of someone beloved. Each deserves contemplation. In Shiva, the first 7 days of mourning, Rabbi Joseph Telushkin writes, after the burial, mourners return home, or ideally to the home of the deceased, to sit for 7 days. Shiva is simply the Hebrew word for seven. During the Shiva week, mourners are expected to remain at home and sit on low stools. This last requirement is intended to reinforce the mourner's inner emotions. In English, we speak of feeling low as a synonym for depression. In Jewish law, this depression is acted out literally. Have I lost track of the snake in this serpentine entry? Well, sir, there will be no snake handling in the church in the greenhouse, nor any snake worship. But what if metaphorically or spiritually we might charm the snake? What if we dance the snake charmer's dance? What if we tune in to fascination and wonder as part of our personal church? Today, I will be dancing. Blessings. Tamara. And one more entry from this. April 27th, 2020, the bloom is off. The magnificent lily that glowed and grinned like a tiger has dropped her blooms and hidden herself for the year. I have the plant still healthy and the memory of her beauty and presence and a bit of sadness. It is a similar sadness to the way I miss certain friendships that have faded. One I am thinking of particularly now has lingered on my mind of late. I long to be in touch, but when one loves, one waits and carries on. The other may have found new attachments or distractions or his or her own overwhelming circumstances, and the bloom is off the rose or lily, so to speak. We feel forgotten, and there's some chance we are. Isn't that humbling? There's a better chance that we are remembered, like the tiger lily who once shone so brightly in the life of our absent friend. We are like a softer painting of that lily now, in memory perhaps. It's also possible that we flatter ourselves. My friend Alan Mitnick wrote the following poem about the wish to be remembered. I don't want as much to be remembered as just forgotten slowly. One day the mailman bringing a different name on cards and bills to this door. Something I've been learning from my Buddhist studies is that the ego can have a powerful hold. If we can replace our need to be loved and adored and applauded with compassion for others and a spirit of openness with no clutching, we can be happier and probably do much more good with our lives. Here, I'll take lead of you, and you needn't remember me at all, but do come around if you think of it. Blessings. Tamara.
1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, here. Nope.
Good morning. It's me. Can you hear me?
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then you tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more, and more, and more, and more.
John Etchem, writing from Eboland. Biafra, as they call it. Name of the poem is Life is a Forest, he would say. My grandfather was a mystical man to me. He would take me as a boy to hunt antelopes and other wild animals in the dense forest. Sometimes he would place me in a circle and give me a sacred leaf to put in my mouth. He would instruct me not to leave the circle until he returned, come what may. One day we came upon a rocky slope, shaded by a beret of trees that urinated water from its crevices. One of his traps was bent akimbo into a dark hole. He said nothing to me. He said nothing to me, but his severe face told me there was danger in there. He thrust a long stick into the hole before pulling out what was there. It was a giant python caught by the trap. It had fought and pulled the wire that ate deep into its flesh. With rage and without fear, he pinned the serpent to the ground and, with a perfect deep machete thrust, chopped off its head. Yes, it was a spectacle I'll never forget. He draped the serpent around his neck, and with bloodshot eyes he staggered through the wild grass, the blood of the serpent baptizing him, like some sacred ancestor's ritual. As we pulled out of the dark forest, the early morning spiraled with thunder and lightning, flogging the cocoa trees around us. I fled downhill like a squirrel frightened from a tree, through pathless forest, into a distant farmland, panting for breath, a lyrical bird singing overhead. Noticing some connections between the various pieces here. We have snakes, we have spaceships, and everything, of course, is a butterfly. Jimmy Heffernan, Notes on UFOs, which, of course, are types of butterflies. And the quotation that starts us off by Sarah Scholes is, "The universe is stranger than a thing that simply spits out spaceships." As Robert Anton Wilson and others have noted, if one really looks at the mounting body of UFO evidence objectively, it is very difficult, if not preposterous, to see UFO contactees as merely having random, disjointed hallucinations. There is an ordering, a hierarchy of patterns involved with what these people report. Moreover, frequently the phenomenon is shared by multiple people, sometimes up to hundreds of them. You've got to admit, at the very least, that some coherent phenomenon is causing a whole crowd of people to hallucinate the same thing simultaneously. Relevant to this topic is a just-published and rollicking romp around the peculiar world of UFO culture. They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers, by Sarah Scholes. Scholes shows us a side of America that is poorly understood by most people, and much more complicated and nuanced than most casual skeptics would suspect. The book does not require one to be a believer, in fact it's rather the other way around, but she does give voice to everyone involved in every facet of the rather opaque, otherworldly diamond, the fanatics, the investigators, the skeptics, the kooks, the government. She shows us that there is a lot of misplaced passion when it comes to UFOs, but that the real question is not whether they are piloted by aliens from other planets, but rather what causes this phenomenon and how do we account for that small fraction of sightings that cannot be explained away. Scholes also delves into the infamous so-called Roswell incident on June 14, 1947, at a rural ranch some miles from Roswell, New Mexico. Vernon Brazel and his father William discovered some very strange material on the property. They described in their original report the apparent wreckage as made up of rubber strips, tinfoil, tough heavy paper, and sticks, not unlike a giant downed kite. That was it, no mention of bodies. The government claimed it was a scientific balloon designed to measure radiation in the atmosphere, and perhaps naturally many in the UFO community have come to see this as a pathetic cover-up. But having considered these details, I'm now not so sure. I mean, tinfoil, rubber tape, paper and sticks? This does not sound like hyperdimensional technology to me. Anthropologists have determined the essential dynamics when it comes to many UFO believers. If a story has not been discredited scientifically, then of course it must be true. If a story has been so discredited, this is easily explained away as the result of a government cover-up. And so we see that it is nearly impossible for many UFO believers to invalidate any claim. More than half a century before Scholes' volume appeared, the famous Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung also published a book on the subject in 1958, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies. In it, he attempts to explain much of the UFO phenomenon as a projection of his famous archetypes. This is a psychological phenomenon, not one of interstellar diplomacy. There's a distinct waxing and waning in the frequency of sightings, and Jung felt this could in part be attributed to times when humans felt most threatened and insecure and powerless. In other words, when they needed the power of myth the most. I definitely agree with Jung that this whole constellation has the nature of a deep psychological phenomenon and that this can be extremely affecting. So affecting that things can get legitimately weird even without aliens. Perhaps, if an intelligent species can get past blowing itself up, technological advancement might actually reach the point that they would transcend matter and energy and go into a higher dimension of reality. Of course, this connects back to Raymond's piece about the Imandians. Of course, several hypotheses in physics, including to an extent quantum theory, unequivocally posit dimensions beyond the four we're familiar with. So perhaps at a certain point, putative aliens would not exist in physical bodies transmitting light signals, but would simply vanish from our consensus reality. Western civilization has always been in large part about expansion and conquest. Anthropologists know that the vast majority of human cultures over time were, instead, sustainable and local. So the notion that we must jump off this planet and continue this behavior elsewhere may not be something one sees in the universe very much. Certainly many social commentators and comedians have pointed out that if we go off-planet, all we'll do is pollute and ruin world after world, some manifest destiny. So if you're just tuning in, this is Nathan reading excerpts from the Cenacle, Summer 2020, which came out recently. It's sort of still summertime, Cenacle time. Welcome back to Cenacle Time. A little bit of Many Musics by Raymond Solar Jr., beginning with a quotation from George MacDonald in his book Lilith, 1895. I tell you there are more worlds and more doors to them than you will think of in many years. So, Many Musics. One, This is the 12th series of many musics. 1. Cackle. Long before men and down below sight there is green. Webs upon webs, before story, before song, veining down through the living world, there is green. Whirled by light, a combustion to glory, now mixed with seawater, there is music, there is life, there is green. All unitive to grow, to flourish and bloom, feed to flourish, feed to bloom, live forever without end, there is music, there is green. A kind of through all, wherefrom comfort, wherefrom healing, wherefrom a unitive of many, behold it. Things change, tides combust, now islands emerge, land becomes, the green ever on, now a woods rises of birch and oak and pine and 100 other kinds, new to light, ancient its web, down deeper than sea, down to the heart of the world, feel its green, feel its humming, the humming throughout the one woods, throughout the wide, wide sea, throughout all that emerges yet one. From the outermost leaf on a stormy day, from snaggle of sun and surf where many play, from the winking starlight of many paths and places come to hear, there is a cackle. The green now wishes to play, spread a natural theater upon the world of mountains, deserts, beaches far below the sea. The green must turn on the one woods to 1,000 colors and nuts and fruits. The green shall still back to its unitive way, and now cackle, and now ever on. Then, falling into time, one day above, in that familiar blue, a novel one now appears, a thing of men not yet dreamed, from a sometime far when. A blue suitcase falls to the sea with a great curse splash, and things change and tides combust, and the green cackles, and time to play. 2. And then, things change, they don't undo, the heart of the world beats through time, the heart of all worlds beats through all times, the hearts of all worlds beat, a drumming path, a breathing the creatures nap, peaceable, and then they wake. So, gliding ahead, step by step, skipping over the beautiful illustrations. Whoa, here's one. There we go. Just pop that up there. Cassie Sollard lushly illustrates this beautiful magazine every quarter. Tom Sheen, or Sheehan. It's one of them Irish names that sometimes has one syllable or two. And this poem is called Coupled. Coupled. The long rope of evening tightens its soft noose. Slack falls away from the barn and sits down in goldenrod field like a Guernsey waiting for hands, tired of heavy suspension. By the window, your eyes catch neither star nor firefly, nothing shaken to superlatives, just a small scar of light stolen from the art of darkness itself, just the thinned edge of dream working out of a dim retreat. We always separate this way, as if night is a wedge or wall, final hard divider of the day, a bolt thrown home by pale hand, sounding ultimate punctuation. You, dashing into tomorrow before it takes a first breath. Me, at our history's lectern, a professor of yesterday's, calipers in hand, measuring littered wayside and footpaths, bringing us to the schismatic twilight. We stand apart, form and matter of arguments, apt deliberations, one part silk and one part burlap. Oh, how we love differences and shadows falling threats. Martina Newberry, Clouds Like Boxcars, in memory of Larry Kramer. To stay sane, I research and pore over the small things, a chipped fingernail, an odd-colored feather gracing the ground, an undefinable spot on the kitchen floor, a television show, a book of crosswords. Around my diversions, the wars continue. They blend into each other like creeks into lakes, into rivers, into oceans. One immeasurable ocean. Unending tides of death. Ineloquent battles. In defense of nothing we can remember. Something, someone is always looking for a new place to send someone else to fight and die. The endless ocean reflects heartbroken stars. A morose moon, white as bone. Clouds, like boxcars, rolling and rolling, stopping only to pick up more detritus, more compromised air, stopping only to deliver all of it over an aching land. None of us has to be told to be still anymore. Our thoughts, the static of our consciences, simmer inside our brains. We watch the skies for that specter of peace, a summer of love, and still, and still. When did the gods decide that things were too easy for us? When did our torpid breezes turn to strong winds that howl and stumble below the canyons? No matter. The war, the one war, the only war, goes on. We live inside our own dreams, sorting particles of what we believe is right from larger particles of what it takes to be happy. We falter as we stand on the foundations of our own souls. Our bodies are haunted by the tough touch of time. What will happen? We ask ourselves. What will happen? We ask our loved ones. What will happen? We ask the craters of the moon. What will happen? We ask our fathers and brothers. Our mothers always knew. Chthonic answers flood the world, won't let go, and chthonic spirits continue to watch and whisper. There will be rumors of war, they say, and there will be war. My answer is always the same. To stay sane, I research and pore over the small things. A chipped fingernail, an odd-colored feather gracing the ground, an unidentifiable spot on the kitchen floor, a television show, a book of crosswords. Hold steady, I say. Judy Haggai from a kibbutz in Israel with haiku. Dear COVID-19, I understand I must stay put. No journey to school. Today's date arrives, just as it has in the past. Memories of Dad. Exhale the tensions. Prepare body for dawn's input. Birds and fresh jasmine. Birds on high volume. Ripples of life energy penetrate my heart. A quiet moment, body breathes, muscles relaxed, a perfect present. This moment, this place, this breath, this, and now, this. Bird news on the wire, safe to wander kibbutz trails, all clear with blessings. Figure on the night path, binoculars in focus. Dialogue with bird. Dust settles, one foot into the other. One foot in front of the other, into clarity. Dust settles, one foot in front of the other, into clarity. Ace Bogus. Another interstellar space travel poem. This is called Another Earth-like Planet. 13 light years distant. Not so far if you're a being of pure energy. Post-transcendent Siddhartha radiating. Selfless. For the rest of us, we can't conjure it in imagined sleep of a sci-fi cryo tank. We're millions of lost anchors at the bottom of an ocean trench, so deep nothing on the surface calls us. We settle for sedentary lives, sometimes not noticing space around us, sometimes wondering what's out there and if we could be happy on another world, without lugging our miseries to not Earth, to plant them like another goddamned flag. Last poem by Colin James called Caligula in Texarkana. Empathizing with an old girlfriend, I helped her train her pet eagle, Caligula. One day he was particularly distraught, so I took him to the movies, thinking the darkness might soothe. But still he wouldn't settle until Richard Burton soliloquized. Recently, Caligula had learned to communicate other than by telepathy, so I asked him what he had thought of Clint Eastwood's German accent. He replied, without hesitation, like snow falling off a roof, like snow falling off a roof. So this has been a reading of a whole bunch of stuff, lit stuff. Like that. Whose work is it but your own to open your eyes? So Cenacle, a tool of perception. Great gratitude to Raymond Sollard and all the contributors. Again, we heard from, through me, Timothy Vilgiati, Raymond Sollard Jr., Sam Knott, Tamara Miles, John Etchem, Jimmy Heffernan, Tom Sheen, Martina Newberry, Judy Haggai, Ace Bogus, and Colin James. I hope you enjoyed this as you floated in and out of it. It's always here on the internet forever. Enjoy. Thanks for coming to the party. Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm a traveler up on Thank you.